From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Thursday, October the 3rd, 2019. Thanks very much for joining us this morning. Got a full 2 hours of talk radio for you lined up. We are going to be talking first with Kit Norton of VTDigger.org. He is that terrific news outlet's political reporter. He's been following the Bernie Sanders campaign quite closely, in part because Bernie, of course, being from Vermont, gets the attention of our local online news outlet, VTDigger.org. And we're going to be talking about some good news and some bad news for Bernie Sanders this week. We'll get to that in just a moment. After I tell you what's coming up later in the show, Christopher Kaufman-Ilstrup is the our next guest. He's our second guest today. He's going to be coming in the 9:30 to 10-ish block, and he's going to be talking to us about his role as executive director of the Vermont Humanities Council and their role as a host of a very interesting, I think, and going to be very quite well-attended event next Monday evening at the Flynn Theater in Burlington, where Congressman John Lewis, the longtime civil rights veteran, is going to be making an appearance there and talking about his new graphic novel, March Book One. And so we're going to be hearing from Christopher Kaufman-Ilstrup about the appearance of John Lewis coming up at the Flynn next week. And I also want to just check in with Christopher about other doings of the Vermont Humanities Council, which is they bring a lot of important stuff to the state in terms of literature and thinking and all sorts of good activities. So we'll hear a little bit about the Humanities Council then. In the latter hour, another group that we haven't given enough attention on the Dave Graham Show here at WDEV is going to get a little bit today, and that is 4-H, the venerable agricultural training and youth organization. We're going to be hearing from Director Sarah Kleinman, a student at CVU who's in 4-H, and the I believe her name is Lena Ashu, if I'm pronouncing that right. We'll double check as she approaches the scene here. And her mom is Sarah Nilsson, and the three of them are going to be crowding into our tiny studio here to tell us all about 4-H, and I'm looking forward to that conversation as well. But let's get started this morning with Kit Norton. Kit, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure, Dave.
And you have been busy this week reporting a couple different things about Bernie Sanders. One is a big fundraising haul. The other is a little bit of a health scare, I guess you might call it. What's going on with Bernie?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm sure as most of us know, yesterday it was announced by the campaign that the senator had gone through a heart surgery, two stents, which are basically two tubes that allow blood to flow to and from the heart correctly, or inserted into an artery, which was found to be clogged. So this is definitely a bit of a health scare for the senator. But by all accounts, he's up and raring to go, even though the campaign has been put on basically an indefinite pause button has been pushed on it.
Yeah, it's interesting. This procedure, by the way, with stents, I'm close to people who have had it, and it seems to be very, very common these days. It's kind of an amazing thing. I'm told that you actually can get they insert a tube into your blood vessel, sometimes in your upper thigh or sometimes even in your wrist or something, if I understand this correctly, and they can shoot the stent up the blood vessel and get it into place without actually opening up your chest to do surgery there. And it's and I guess it's quite a common thing these days, and it actually does enable people to rebound and recover and get back to their normal lives within just typically a couple of days of this procedure. Is that your understanding as well?
That's right. We spoke with the head cardiologist at the UVM Medical Center, and this was exactly what he was saying. You know, this is a highly common procedure to be done now, and in the mass majority, basically, you know, the 80% of the procedures that are done on folks, you know, they're done on people who it's not life threatening, and that they will live completely, normal lives moving forward and will not have to worry much about their heart after that. Of course, that being said, heart conditions are something that you always want to keep an eye on.
And the other sort of tough aspect about this is much more amorphous, but I guess it does, as political pundits or whatever, we need to pay this some attention, which is just that you know, Bernie Sanders is the oldest of the candidates in the race. He's not the only rather elderly candidate in the race, but he happens to be in the lead. And if aging is a contest, and do you think this hurts him politically?
I think there's no doubt that it's a concerning sign for the campaign and for supporters of the campaign. If you look at the senator, you know, he's 78 now. If you were to win the presidency, he'd be 83 at the end of his first term.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, age has been an issue brought up by constituents, possible voters during this election cycle. We've seen it with former Vice President Joe Biden, who's 76, 2 years younger than Bernie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, concerns about his mental faculties all being there. And then also, even though she's a little younger, even with Elizabeth Warren, you know, we kind of have the three front runners. I mean, she's 70. We all have them in this type of age range.
And of course, President Trump is 73, so
that's
he's
right.
not a spring chicken either.
That's right. Yep. That's right.
I mean, it's interesting, though, because what I notice among just elderly relatives and friends and people do age at different rates. And so you can have a 78-year-old who is still cognitively sharp as a tack and a 76-year-old who's starting to lose a step. You can have a 78-year-old who is... could go out and play a game of pickup basketball, and you could have a 63-year-old who would be huffing and puffing after 2 minutes of that. So there's a lot of different rates at which people age, I guess, is what I'm thinking here. And Bernie Sanders, from all external appearances anyway, looks like somebody who is actually quite a young 78.
That is a very good observation. I mean, look, he's been campaigning like a madman since February and hasn't let up at all. He's taken a few breaks here and there, but it's been really quite incredible. And the campaign has repeatedly said staffers who are with him say, oh, you know, and these are staffers who are, you know, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, who say, you know, I have a hard time keeping up with him. And that's an ongoing joke, which, you know, is held over from the 2016 election.
Yeah.
So again, it's all about, you know, he's in terrific shape. He's in better shape than I am, you know, is what all the staffers always say.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen him around a few times covering him over the years, and one of the things I've noticed is, you know, as he got into his 60s and 70s, he's typically a few steps ahead of his entourage, and they're all kind of scurrying to keep up with a guy who walks very fast, and he's not at all overweight, it doesn't seem, and of course I guess he is really careful about his diet and his exercise and all of that stuff that helps you stay healthy deep into old age, and again, this procedure that he had this week, I don't want to say it's like, you know, filling a cavity, but it seems to be getting increasingly routine out there in the medical world. And it seems like he's, you know, good to go for a while yet. And whether you like him or not as a politician or agree with his positions or whatever, you obviously wish him the best and hope that he has got some years left on him. So let's. But the other big news about Bernie Sanders this week was that and I was joking with somebody yesterday where I said, if somebody told me I had just hauled in $25 million, I might have heart palpitations too or something. But he got a big fundraising haul here this week where he actually raised about that much money.
Yeah, just over that amount. And the campaign announced that actually the same day, which it turned out he was having this procedure done. That was on Tuesday earlier this week. But yes, he brought in $25.3 million in the third quarter, which is that's the high mark for any Democratic candidate for this election cycle. Last quarter, the quarter before this, the second quarter, he only brought in $18 million, which was a bit of a slip. And South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg was actually the one leading. He raised well over $20 million that time. But this time, so far, he's leading the pack with a very, very massive boost in the fundraising game.
What do you think explains that? I mean, it struck me as almost a little odd because a lot of the coverage of Sanders over the summer I saw your story recently talking about how Elizabeth Warren had actually taken some of his donors away.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the 2016 Bernie Sanders donors were moving over to Warren, and it just seemed as though he didn't quite have the same luster that he had when he was the lone Wolf on the left back in 16, challenging Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination. The Bernie Sanders this time was getting some press over the summer, indicating that maybe he's not going to be the sort of alternative to the middle of the road folks in the Democratic primary. And yet he makes this huge fundraising haul. I'm trying to square these two. How do you do that?
Well, first you have to look at, it's been a strategy from day one by the campaign to look at these small, what they're calling grassroots donations. They're really going after, you know, the people who are giving $1, you know, $2.70, and not necessarily folks who are giving in larger amounts of cash. This has been their strategy from day one. Along with that, it's been very clear that they're looking for online donations. And this has been, again, a strategy which was kind of, he started in 2016, and now he's made even better this time around. You know, and also the news coming out, it should not be that much of a surprise, because other reporting has shown that across the country he leads the pack in basically every corner of the United States in terms of fundraising and fundraising amounts and folks who are giving. And the campaign has also been very proud to announce that, you know, they have the most individual donors. You know, they always boast that, you know, they're leading the pack. It was 800,000 earlier this summer. Now there are over 1 million different folks who have given money. So in that aspect, it should not be a surprise that he's been doing so well. And it's something, because he's been swearing off big money donors, private fundraiser events, that he's been targeting these folks. So that should not be coming as much of a surprise. But then to discuss the part about him losing a bit of his luster, I mean, this is something that holds up if you speak with people on the ground, whether it be in Iowa or New Hampshire, and with folks who are what we consider big money donors, people who give over $1,000 to him in 2016, you know, quite a few. Of course, it's small in the realm of total contributions that he received in 2016 have switched to Elizabeth Warren. And a lot of them say, listen, you know, I respect Bernie. I voted for Bernie. I think he's great. This time, I think, is, you know, his time has passed, and Elizabeth Warren is a better messenger. And that is something that I hear again and again from supporters on the ground as well.
Is some of that the fact that Elizabeth Warren's a woman, and there are women's groups out there, feminists, who really want to support a female candidate?
Yes, not just women, I might add. You know, speaking with a lot of men out who are listening to what the candidates have to say, There seems to be a growing appetite for a female candidate, mm-hmm. And that this is the right time for that.
Interesting. I mean, it's almost as if folks are maybe thinking we kind of missed an opportunity with Hillary Clinton in 2016 for a wide variety of reasons, which we can probably go into on another edition of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV. But I do think that there was some real strong desire there to cross that threshold of saying, you know, in 2008 we elected our first black African-American candidate president of the United States. It looked like we were going to elect our first woman in 2016. That the second part of that story didn't come out the way a lot of folks were hoping and expecting even. And so let's try again on that front, on the idea of electing a female candidate. Maybe that there's some animus, motivation directed in that way.
Yeah, for sure. There is, as I was saying, a definite appetite for a strong female candidate with a progressive agenda. You know, it's kind of that perfect storm this time around. And I even spoke to a couple in Keene, New Hampshire, just last week, who one of them supported Hillary Clinton in 2016. However, she had hoped that Hillary was going to name Elizabeth Warren as her VP pick, but now this time around she's fully behind Warren. So yeah, there's definitely this sentiment spreading around possible voters.
Yeah, and of course, so one of the interesting things to watch here too is the role of New Hampshire. New Hampshire, of course, being the first primary state, Iowa caucuses happened a little before. But the first primary in New Hampshire, and it obviously gets outsized media coverage just because it's the first in on the list. And New Hampshire has a history of supporting its fellow New Englanders in primaries. I mean, you think back to Paul Tsongas won the New Hampshire primary in 1992, and then his campaign kind of fizzled after that. And he was from Lowell, Mass. Ed Muskie, 1972, won the New Hampshire primary. His campaign fizzled after New Hampshire. New Englanders get a boost, don't they, in New Hampshire?
Yes. Yes.
So last New Englander to lose was Howard Dean, and of course he lost to John Kerry from Massachusetts. Mm. So Bernie Sanders may have a tough road against Elizabeth Warren in New Hampshire because she's got the Boston media market, and so we'll have to see what happens there. Kit, I wanted to pull the lens back a little bit on the overall campaign and the arc of the campaign. Of course, one of the big things happening, obviously, is all this talk about impeachment of the president of the United States. Politico had a very interesting piece a couple days ago where they were essentially saying that impeaching President Trump could really, in a lot of ways, upend the Democratic primary campaign because several of the Democratic candidates have really kind of built their campaigns and their whole reasons for running and so on around a critique of President Trump. If Trump is away from the picture, if now I guess the Republican heir apparent would be Mike Pence, how do you think that might play out? Do you have any good speculation for us?
Yeah, the good speculation, yeah. It would really throw it completely for a loop. You have Joe Biden. He's, you know, again and again, he's made the point that this is, he's running a campaign to correct what President Donald Trump has done and go back to the good old days of President Barack Obama. California Senator Kamala Harris, very similarly, she's harped on having to beat Donald Trump again and again, and this is her main stump speech in a lot of ways. So yes, there are a lot of these candidates who have made it their reason for running around beating President Donald Trump.
Biden is Mr. Not Trump also, isn't he?
Or Joe Biden, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
So in some ways, do you think that Bernie might remain as a little bit of a standout or unusual here because his critique is, I mean, he bashes Trump like the rest of them, but he also kind of bashes the overall oligarchy and the whole, you know,
right,
wealth inequality to a kind of a purer extent, doesn't he?
Yes. I mean, this is where Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Bernie Sanders, they will remain being very strong candidates if indeed impeachment goes through, which is a whole different
question. Sure.
Yes, question. Yeah. Yeah. But this is something that sets them apart as candidates, and with again the progressive agenda they've put forward, and they're very similar on this. They're the two who have not mentioned Trump the most during that. One, there's some speeches across the country, also on the debate stage. You know, they are the ones who are tending to stick to policy instead of President Donald Trump.
Interesting. We have a caller on the line. Let's go to Karen in Hardwick. Good morning, Karen.
I wonder if you could talk about Tulsi Gabbard. She's the one I like best, and she's just disappeared.
Okay. Kit, talk about Tulsi Gabbard. What do you think? Does she have a chance? Is she going to be a nominee or vice presidential pick?
Well, she will be on the next debate stage, October 15th. She made the high water mark, which the DNC, Democratic National Committee, set. She did make that one, even though she missed the last one. And with her, what you have is someone who served in the military, congresswoman from Hawaii, again, you know, quite progressive agenda as well, a bit of an acolyte of Senator Bernie Sanders, but not polling well at all. Mm-hmm. Even though she's been very active, I was just in Iowa last week, and she was there at the Democratic steak fry, 10,000 steaks being fried up, and she was there. She had a bit of a crowd around her, not much, but folks are definitely interested in hearing what she has to say, and she has a bit of a, you know, cult following, not quite as much as, say, another one of the outsider possibilities, Andrew Yang, but definitely a bit of a following.
Steak fry. And then the next week, one of the candidates comes out with a clogged artery.
I know.
I'm just trying to figure out if there's any possible relation here. And Karen, I don't know if you're still on the line, but my sense of Tulsi Gabbard is that she has been a very interesting candidate as somebody who's probably may factor in a big way in the future. She's still very young, and I think she, a lot of people kind of look at her and say, interesting, attractive, articulate. She's got a lot of potential. Just not quite ready. Do you think that's the bottom line here, Kit?
Yes, I think it also comes down to, I mean, this election, folks, whether they be in South Carolina, New Hampshire, Iowa, et cetera, you know, this is about getting the best candidate to beat Donald Trump. The electability is an issue that comes up again and again. And so it comes down to, is someone who has, you know, low name recognition, is kind of new to the national political stage, would she have a shot? And so they're putting that ranking electability ahead of just liking her policies and liking her.
Yeah. So somebody to watch in maybe 24 or 28 or something like that. But and it's possible she could be a vice presidential pick for someone this time around, which obviously would give her a huge boost going into those later elections. But as of now, I think the poll numbers tell a story here, and we'll have to see. Who knows? We've seen primaries. Remember, Iowa's still months away. New Hampshire's still months away. Anything can happen. So let us not lock things in too tightly here.
Never.
So good strategy. Hey, Kit Norton of VTDigger.org, I thank you so much for stopping in this morning and sharing with us your insights. And back out there on the campaign trail, I wish you good travels there. We're going to take a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show. When we come back, we're going to be hearing from Christopher Kaufman Ilstrup of the Vermont Humanities Council about a very important upcoming event that organization is sponsoring. We'll be back shortly, folks. Stay with us.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
And we are back on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. I want to remind folks about our podcast. If you are unable to listen to the whole show between 9 and 11 a.m. because, you know, you have a dentist appointment or you have a work thing going on or something else that keeps you away from the radio or the live stream on your computer, then you can always tune into our podcast any time of day or night and get caught up with what we've been talking about here. Just go to the WDEVradio.com homepage, follow the link from there to the Dave Graham Show, scroll down a bit, and you will come up with a list of our recent programs by guest and by topic. And for instance, later on today, when the podcast gets posted, I suspect you will see the name of Christopher Kaufman Ilstrup of the Vermont Humanities Council, who's my next guest. Before we get to Christopher, I want to thank the Warren Store, the friendly, funky, and almost world-famous Warren Store, for its sponsorship of our podcast. But speaking of Christopher Kaufman Ilstrup, the executive director of the Vermont Humanities Council, he's now sitting across the table from me here in our little studio at WDEV in Waterbury. And Christopher, thanks very much for joining me this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dave.
And hey, folks, I also want to issue the reminder that our call-in number is 244-1777 here in Waterbury. The toll-free number, 1-877-291-8255 or 291-TALK. And you're always welcome to join the conversation. Christopher, wanted to bring you in today because the Vermont Humanities Council has a very exciting upcoming event. What's that?
Well, you know, folks out there might know that we pick one book every year for our Vermont Reads Project, and about 100 communities around the state read the same book together. Senior centers, middle schools, high schools, churches, community centers, all kinds of folks get together and they do projects around one book. This year's book is a very special book. It's called March. It's by Representative John Lewis and his colleagues Andrew Aiden and Nate Powell. It's a graphic novel, and it's a biography of John Lewis, who folks might know was the founding director of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and one of the big six leaders of the civil rights movement in the 1960s with Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King.
And I read, you know, I think in one of your promotional materials that King had actually done some cartooning and that sort of thing. Had he?
Yeah, you know, this book was actually inspired by a comic book that came out in 1957 that was the story of Martin Luther King organizing in the South. And so this book, this new book, came out about 5 years ago. And it was really inspired by that original comic book and the organizing work that it did. We're excited because John Lewis is coming to Vermont with his co-writer, Andrew Aden, on Monday and Tuesday. So it's the culmination of a full year's worth of work with the book, and to have such an iconic figure in the state is a really great thing for us.
So he's appearing at the Flynn Theater in Burlington, right?
He is appearing at the Flynn Theater in Burlington. It is wildly sold out. However, we will be, you know, if there are any seats available at about 10 minutes to 7, we will let people who are standing in line into those seats so that we make sure that as many people as possible can get in. We're also really lucky to be partnering with Vermont Public Television, Vermont PBS, and they'll be live streaming the event across the state. So if you have a phone or an iPad or a computer that's connected to the internet, you'll be able to watch the event.
Wow. And that'll probably be appointment viewing for a lot of folks here in Vermont, because John Lewis is a very, very widely admired individual, not just here in Vermont, obviously, but around the country, really around the world. Still a member of Congress after all these years. I mean, it's kind of amazing if you just think about the longevity of this career.
Yeah. You know, he was an organizer for many, many years. And then in the early 1980s, he started to run for office. And he was originally a member of the Atlanta City Council. And then in 1986, 1987, he ran for Congress. And he's been there representing his district in Atlanta, Georgia, ever since.
Yep. And a real veteran on Capitol Hill these days, and somebody who... When you hear him speak, he presents himself in just such a dignified and well spoken manner. It's kind of a pleasure right there, just the civility and he's got a really excellent speaking voice, and I regard it as always kind of a treat to hear him.
He's often called the conscience of the Congress.
The conscience of the, well, somebody's got to do it, right?
Yes, indeed. He certainly has a very strong moral compass.
Yeah, and so John Lewis at the Flynn on Monday, and as you mentioned, sold out, except for if you really think you might get lucky and get to grab maybe the last few dozen seats that might be available on Monday evening, and that's the way a lot of theater productions and other events like this end up happening, is that they get sold out, but then there's always, I don't know if there's an official term for it, but there's kind of a little bit of a wiggle room or something there.
Yeah. Well, we've been working with the Flynn pretty detailed way, and they assure us that they're going to count seats at about 10 minutes to 7 and start letting people in from mm-hmm. the line. So if you want to if you want to try and get in to see him live, feel free to show up. Come on down, get in the line.
And I got to say, the Flynn is, for anybody who hasn't been there, that's a treat too, because it's such a beautiful hall and it's very well managed, and it just feels like you're having a special evening anytime you go there for pretty much anything. Yeah. So,
well, and you know, one of the things that we're really excited about is this Flynn partnership is that John Lewis and his colleague Andrew are going to be doing two student matinees the next day. And we had 5,000 ticket requests from teachers around the state. In the two student matinees, we'll be able to accommodate about 3,000 of those requests. So 3,000 kids will be able to get in and see the congressman the next day.
5,000 ticket requests. So that would account for a significant percentage of all the students in Vermont. Is that right?
For sure. You know, one of the middle schools in Burlington is bringing about 75% of their students.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of magnetism and gravitas that John Lewis has, and it's entirely understandable. Yeah. So, should be quite a couple of days in Burlington as this person who has been a real national treasure for decades now makes an appearance there. And the Vermont Humanities Council, I haven't had the pleasure actually in my first year and a half or so of hosting this radio program on WDEV of having you on here. Let's talk a little more broadly about the Humanities Council in general. Christopher, and you're... you're relatively new there yourself, right?
Yeah, I'm about a year. So mm-hmm. I think we started at about the same time in these new gigs.
And just so everybody knows what a small place Vermont is, I, of course, still work part-time at VT Digger. And that's where you and I first met, because you were the senior business person there at VT Digger before you went to the Humanities Council.
I was. So, yeah. It's a small world.
It really is amazing in Vermont. And so so you go a few blocks from that VT Digger office on State Street over to, I think it's Loomis Street?
Where Loomis Street.
I've seen the sign there and the Vermont Humanities Council. How would you describe the Humanities Council to, just to folks who are kind of vaguely aware that it exists but doesn't really know what it is?
Sure. Yeah. You know, Vermont Humanities Council has been around since 1974. So we're coming up on our 45th anniversary.
Wow.
Our founding director, Victor Swenson, liked to tell the story of how he, on New Year's Day, 1974, he dragged a picnic table up into an office, put a phone on it, and started in. we are part of a national network. There are 56 state humanities, state and territorial humanities councils around the country. Hmm. We're the affiliates of the National Endowment for the Humanities, which was started by Congress in the late 1960s.
I see. Okay.
And, you know, typically we'll do about 840, 850 events in any given year. So we're doing a lot. You know, two or three events a day.
That's a
last
lot.
Night, wow. I was in Middlebury at the college with our First Wednesdays program. We welcomed Brian Terrell Clark, who is a member of the cast of Hamilton, talking about his story coming up from the city of Baltimore and his story of how arts education changed his life and moved him into Broadway. It was a great evening. We had about 100 folks there learning his story, and he even treated us with a little bit of his take on George Washington. That's the character that he plays in Hamilton.
In Hamilton, wow. So that, and did he perform a taste of that role then?
Was he
that
sure the... did. Yeah. He blew us all away, as they say.
I bet when you bring a serious professional theater person into a venue here in Vermont, sometimes it's just people sit there and go, wow.
Indeed.
Now I understand why they're a big deal.
Well, so. And, you know, and we do all kinds of things. So, you know, coming up, we've got a talk on a 19th century murder case called Murder in the Vermont Woods, a story about race, class, and gender in the 19th century. Last night, we also had Alison Bechdel, the cartoonist laureate of Vermont, up in Essex. We have a very popular talk by a fellow that you and I both know, Bill Mayers, who I think is maybe on the board of VT Digger. Mm-hmm. He does a talk around beekeeping and the status of bees in our changing climate. So it's really very diverse. Just you can find just about anything for any interest if you go to our website. www.vermonthumanities.org.
www.vermonthumanities.org. It's just browsing around there, you can really learn a lot about stuff going on in the state, and it's amazingly eclectic. I was going through some of it last night and just thinking to myself, I mean, there are so many different subjects that you folks are covering. Some of them lean toward sort of intellectual, philosophical stuff. Others deal a lot with history and kind of the social issues in our country, and then there are still others that sounds like deal with beekeeping.
We even have a couple of radio talks coming up. We have Erica Heilman coming up in December talking about her podcast Rumble Strip, and we have Jane Lindholm down in Manchester talking about her work on Vermont Edition at Vermont Public Radio.
That's all of it is just seems to be part of a real network here in Vermont, of a terrific continuing conversation that the state has about the issues facing the state and the country and the world, really. And again, the I'm just looking at, for instance, November 6th, here we go, from Rembrandt to Van Gogh and beyond, Vincent Van Gogh's art was among the first that made visible the artist's subjective feelings, an approach later emulated by 20th century artists. Art historian Carol Berry discusses Van Gogh's life, the development of his art, and the artists who influenced him. And this is going to be in Essex Junction at the Brownell Library. Do I have that right?
Yeah.
7 p.m. on November the 6th. And so right there, there's a chance for folks in Chittenden County who want a little bit of want to brighten up their early November with a little bit of culture and art. Head down to the Brownell Library in Essex Junction on the evening of November 6th. And you can hear an art historian, Carol Berry, talking about Van Gogh, Vincent Van Gogh.
And one of the great things about Carol is that she really humanizes Van Gogh. You know, we sort of think about him as, of course, as a masterful painter. Mm-hmm. But we also generally kind of see only the kind of the caricature of Van Gogh as the guy who cut off his ear. And one of the things that Carol Berry can do is really turn him into a real person and talk about his inner life as far as we can discern it from his work and his diaries and journals.
One thing I wanted to ask Christopher about bringing out-of-state dignitaries and celebrities even into Vermont this time of year, there must be a certain extra selling point, right?
Yeah, there sure are. We actually use that in booking people in the fall.
Don't you
want to come to Vermont in the fall?
Yeah, everybody wants to come to Vermont in the fall.
You want to be here, right? Yeah. You want to do that.
Sure. And, you know, use what you got is what I always say. So Vermont has some extraordinary beauty. It's not unique. You know, New Hampshire's got to be about as pretty, parts of Maine, et cetera. But
maybe.
But it is a selling point. So that's great that Vermont's able to take advantage of that. The other thing I wanted to check out with you, Christopher, I've had this theory for a while that, you know, that there's a lot of talk in the national media in particular about elites in America. The coastal elites are supposed to be the bogey people whom all these average Americans are voting against when they vote against Hillary Clinton and for Donald Trump. And I frankly have had severe doubts about the idea that this is a country of elites, or that it needs to be. And I think something like the Vermont Humanities Council, where any member of the public can go to the Brownell Library in Essex Junction in that evening in early November and hear all about Vincent Van Gogh from an art historian, that tells me that we don't have to have elites in this country. We don't have to look at people who care about art and say, oh, they're kind of strange and weird and not me and that sort of thing, because it's available to anybody.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. You know, and that was one of the founding principles of Vermont Humanities. Our founding director, Victor Swenson, just passed away earlier this summer. He often talked about that notion of the humanities is really for everyone. And that was his founding purpose. You know, when he would start book clubs and libraries around the state, it was about making sure that everyone had the opportunity to read, that everyone had the opportunity to learn throughout their life. And we've carried that through in our programming. One of the things that I love most about the job in the summertime is that we run humanities camps for middle school students. And these camps are not necessarily for the kids that are bound for college. These are camps for kids who may be struggling a little bit, who may be what we would call a fragile reader, or kids that don't learn well in a traditional classroom environment. But we're able to give them a week's worth of humanities programming in the summertime that in some cases changes their life. We hear that over and over again from teachers that they are so happy to be able to have this opportunity in the summertime to teach the way that they want to and to work with kids in the way that they need to be worked with. And that really tells us a lot, I think, about the way that we think about young people who may be considered at risk, but actually just need, you know, a little bit of a different way of learning. I was blessed to go up to the St. Albans Humanities Camp earlier in August, and the kids were doing their final presentations on their heroes. And every kid in that humanities camp came up and did a 2 or 3 minute presentation on somebody who was heroic for them. And it was a really great thing to see.
Yeah, I think that's such a key message that really needs to be emphasized. If we are to preserve and enhance democracy in the United States of America, is that, you know, deep thinking and high culture are available to anyone. They need to be available to anyone. I'll just give you one example about deep thinking anyway. One of the finest constitutional scholars I've ever met was a guy by the name of Bill Prescott. He lived in Plainfield. When we were younger, we lived in Plainfield. We're Bill, lucky enough to be Bill's neighbors. Bill was the first in his family to graduate from high school. He would walk from the farm in Plainfield into Barrie to go to Spalding High School on Sunday evening, stay in a rented room in Barrie for, I don't know, a couple bucks a week or whatever, and go back to the farm, do the chores on Friday afternoon and through the weekend. And obviously never went to college. He told me once the farthest he'd ever traveled was Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And yet he loved the Constitution and was a real expert on all of its provisions and had done a lot of reading just in libraries and stuff about the Constitution. And it was an amazing thing to talk to him about the Constitution. And to me, that was kind of the ideal that I'm trying to drive at here now, is that here's a dairy farmer from Plainfield who just cares about the ideas behind the United States Constitution. What a beautiful thing.
Yeah. So, you know, we bring celebrities like our Hamilton actor last night, Brian Terrell Clark, and mm-hmm. John Lewis to Vermont. But yep. A lot of our programs are with just regular people who have studied and learned and care about a topic. You know, we have had last night in Rutland, and then later in the winter in Newport, a woman named Josie Levitt. Some of you might know Josie as a stand-up comedian, and she's really, really funny. But she also went through a fight with cancer in the last couple of years. And she's presenting for us on her struggle with cancer and what it meant to her in her life and in her community to go through that struggle. And, she's just a regular Vermonter coming out and telling her story.
That's a great thing. What a human thing to do. And that's one of the really lucky things about the fact that we all get to be human. Mm-hmm. So and speaking of human, the Humanities Council is delving into all of humanity's various aspects, obviously. I think it's a really quite a mission. Tell me a little bit about how are you feeling in terms of you mentioned federal funding and support and that sort of thing, and the fact that it's a creature of the national National Endowment for the Humanities?
The National Endowment for the Humanities is our primary funder.
Are you still getting good support from the feds, or is it waning, or where are we on that?
You know what? It actually grows a little bit every year. So I think that really says a lot about Congress and the fact that they do care about education in this country and education for all people. Periodically there are politicians that pop up and say, this is not the federal government's business. We should not be in it. You know, we have one of those right now. But typically our checks and balances system works pretty well. And the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts have survived and largely thrived. We are a tiny, tiny, tiny part of the federal budget. We're way less, for example, than our Army bands. But we're thankful for the support of Congress. And certainly thankful for the support of Patrick Leahy and Bernie Sanders and Peter Welch over many years.
Do you do some private fundraising as well?
We do. Yep. About half of our fundraising is privately raised dollars. So, and that's a requirement of the NEH, that we match our federal dollars with locally raised dollars.
So speaking of checks and balances, folks, send them a check so they can keep their balance up.
Yes, please.
We are fast approaching the top of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. My guest has been Christopher Kaufman Ilstrup, the Executive Director of the Vermont Humanities Council. Christopher, thanks so much for coming in this morning. I wish you good luck hosting John Lewis next week. It's going to be an exciting time for you.
We're very excited. I hear your colleague Mark Johnson is going to be covering the event for Digger.
For Digger, excellent. That's a great call by the Digger editors. So, all right. Well, we are going to go to a top of the hour break with some CBS News, a couple words from sponsors, back with more of the Dave Graham Show in the second hour. Shifting our attention to 4-H, another terrific organization in Vermont, hearing about what they're up to. So stay with us, folks. More good conversation to come here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toten Code, Fashion Forward, Tonya DeBellis, and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back, continuing into our second hour of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. And just wanted to open up the phone lines for the next few minutes. We're expecting three guests, actually, in around the quarter hour or so here. And we'll probably be taking a little break then to get them lined up in the studio here. But between now and then, if anybody out there has some thoughts you'd like to share about the latest news out of Washington or anything else going on out there, 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury. The toll-free number, 1-877-291-8255 or 291-TALK. And obviously curious to know what folks think about, for instance, the first half hour of the program with Kit Norton of VTDigger.org talking about Bernie Sanders running into a little bit of a health issue this week. Nothing we think terribly serious, but something that still is a sign perhaps of the fact that he's 78 years old. He had was found to have a little bit of chest pain, clogged artery, got a couple of stents. Of course, this procedure is very, very common these days. It's if you talk to folks in their 60s or 70s, an awful lot of people are walking around with a stent or two or several in their chests. And they seem to be getting along pretty fine while they're walking around with these little tiny devices. And so does that matter? Should it be an issue? Sanders, 78 years, is that an issue in the presidential campaign? Of course, as we were talking about, it seems to be quite a lineup of folks who are getting up there in years. The incumbent president, Donald Trump, is 73. And Joe Biden, 76. Elizabeth Warren is 70. And so, you know, these days folks sometimes say that people are living longer. Maybe 75 is the new 55. Who knows? But that's what seems to be developing in the political scene these days. Of course, there are quite a number of younger candidates as well. Pete Buttigieg is in his late 30s. So if you really want a younger candidate, you've got to. Tulsi Gabbard, also quite young. I don't know whether she's past her 40th birthday yet or not. I don't recall, but she's somewhere in that late 30s, early 40s range. And so all sorts of choices out there for folks who are still shopping around for a presidential candidate. But give us a call and tell us what you think about that. Let's go to Ted from Shelburne. Good morning, Ted.
Thank you very much for the humanities half hour.
Glad to do it.
That was just amazing to me, just because of history mm-hmm. and the direction human enterprises and communications are going these days. I mean, as you know, I'm very interested in young people, especially getting both oars in the water in terms of humanity and learning ways to successfully be cooperative and non-combative as they go through life. I'm always up late at night, and so this is pre-coffee, pre-clarity, but I appreciate the opportunity as usual. Thank you very much.
Alrighty, well, thanks for the call, Ted. I appreciate that. Ted is he's got an interesting pitch he sometimes calls us in with about the Roots of Empathy. It's a Canadian-based education program that tries to work with especially young kids, get young kids thinking about treating each other well, just as a matter of something you really actually do need to think about in order for it to happen. It doesn't seem to happen automatically, and it doesn't happen universally, certainly, in our society. And there is concern about the growing coarseness in our society these days. For instance, I was kind of curious watching some of the commentary yesterday. President Trump was talking about the impeachment matters and using in his public pronouncements a word which used to not be used in polite company. It starts with a B. It It is synonymous with, I guess, organic fertilizer, you might say. And can't really say it on an FCC-regulated radio station even these days, but the President of the United States apparently is okay with saying it. I was noting that some of the media commentary last night was had kind of arched eyebrows about the president's language, and I wondered whether do we think that that is all purely based on some concern about the coarseness of the conversation and an increasing coarseness introduced by the president, you know, somebody who holds an office that has historically been a source of dignity and respect and that and all those sorts of things in our country, and these days is a source of words like the B word for organic fertilizer, and I just wonder whether is some of the arched eyebrow stuff going on genuine? Is there real concern about the coarsening of the language? Heaven knows we see the we see that and hear that all the time in a wide variety of media outlets, online and on cable and et cetera. And again, it's still WDEV's old-style radio station that tries to avoid certain words here on our air. And are those words still to be avoided, or do you think that some of the little bit of a finger wag that was going on yesterday following the president's use of the words might be more a matter of just a sign of political bias? I mean, is this just another way for the media to voice some criticism at the president that may not be fully warranted in this day and age when people drop all sorts of words and language in our public discourse? So that's kind of a question in my mind right now. Are we in a place where we just need to have growing acceptance, including for what our kids hear, of a pretty coarse language sometimes? Or should there be a pushback? Should there be an effort to say, hey, folks, you know, watch the potty mouth, you know, just clean it up and you know, et cetera. And because we don't want to have that kind of decline in the general level of civility in the way we talk to one another and the way our public figures talk to one another. So give us a call here at the WDEV, 244-1777, and you can let us know what you think in the next few minutes before I bring in my next guests and talking about 4-H. I think I may ask them, you know, is one of the principles of 4-H the idea of trying to make sure that kids are taught up to speak, are taught to speak well and to speak respectfully and so on. Let's go to Freddie in Facetown. Freddie, what do you think?
Oh, I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
I said, what do you think about all what's on your mind?
Well, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I do believe that we have lost the art of civil discourse, let alone just plain old civil.
Civility, I think, is the word.
Well, yeah. We aren't civil to each other. We've lost civility in all aspects of our life, but civil, right? We are no longer civil in any aspect of our lives. Mm-hmm. And the more coarse things become, I know I can curse like a sailor, that I am working very hard not to do that and to change my own behavior in response to this.
Yeah.
But my husband and I this weekend were watching football, and anyone who wasn't was being unloyal, right to the Patriots.
Okay.
So there was an ad on TV about a primetime television show,
mm-hmm.
and the women were hitting each other, and it was, I think the show was called Mom, and I thought, holy cow, and then the next one, I think they used the same term that the president used, and that was on in the middle of the afternoon during a sporting event.
Wow. Yeah. Huh.
So it's everywhere, and I think we need to not accept it.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, do you remember what network this was on? I don't recall right off.
No, I don't. Because I was reading, actually not watching.
I think there still is, and somebody could correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I think there still may be a distinction between cable and traditional broadcast networks in terms of the degree to which they are regulated on this stuff. Because I noticed that you know, NBC, CBS, ABC were shying away from. There was another instance of the president using. Oh, he was describing other countries as something holes. I don't remember.
Oh, that. I don't remember, but I get the other aspect of
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and I think that was sort of seen as permitted on CNN because CNN's cable and not regulated to the same extent as the broadcast networks are. And so you actually had two different ways to go here just because of the way the history of our communication systems has unfolded in the last 30 years or whatever.
Well, I think it was Channel 3, which is CBS.
Okay.
But I won't... Yeah, you know, swear to that.
Yeah, and standards do change. I mean, you know, I remember back in the '60s, the famous comedian George Carlin came up with a hilarious routine about seven words you should never say on the radio.
Yes,
and that was all very kind of radical and renegade and funny and all that great stuff. And yet there were still this bottom line point and that made it funny that you actually weren't. Nobody said these words on the radio.
But look at our common. Everyday usage of language, we curse more mm-hmm. than ever.
Yeah, I suspect you're right about that. I mean, just in terms of you know, road rage incidents, the language that people use, and just around you know, the workplace and around wherever people are, there seems to be much less reluctance, and some of that, you know, there's an argument that says. Let's all kind of be cool and hip and not be you know, not be
square
and not and not be rigid in our behavior and be a little freer and more expressive and it's a way to but frankly I hear a torrent of cuss words, I oftentimes think to myself that if you actually look at the way somebody might have expressed a similar sentiment in literature, you know, a character in a novel from 150 years ago or something. That expression of the from the novel was really much more clever and interesting and original and et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely.
Than just dropping the F-bomb every sentence. So,
well, my mother-in-law, her most outrageous curse word 35 years ago was gods of war. And if yeah. she said that, well, you knew things were, bad.
Think back to, I mean, there's one of my favorite shows on as a little kid on TV was Superman, and there was the editor of the paper there, the Daily Planet, Perry White, I think was the fictional name of the guy. And his great utterance was, "Great Caesar's ghost!" You know, and I guess that was sort of similar to what other folks would burst out with stuff we can't say on the radio today. But anyway, yeah, I appreciate the call. I got to move on to my next one, but I appreciate your thoughts. I think it's interesting stuff. Let's go to Mike in Berlin.
Hi, Dave. How's it going?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing good. Do you remember what Kamala Harris said about President Trump about impeaching the mother?
No, that wasn't Kamala Harris.
It wasn't? Who was it then?
I believe it was Rashida Tlaib.
Okay, that's another one there. Kind of makes you wonder about using foul language in public, doesn't it?
I don't approve of that either.
I don't either.
Yeah. And
when I hear people saying that, you know, even when I'm in private, you know, I kind of like, I don't like to hear that. But, you know, I guess they say people who swear are more intelligent than other ones, is what I've heard. So I guess I avoid swearing, so I guess I'm not as intelligent as most people.
Well, I don't know. I saw that headline about people who swear being more intelligent, and I said, yeah, I'd have to really make a study of that data. I mean, frankly, I'm not completely opposed to dropping a swear word here and there in my just a conversation around the house with my wife or whatever. I'm not a super prude about this stuff, I guess is what I'm saying. But I think when you're president of the United States, or you're a member of Congress, but especially president, and I frankly do think that the words of a president carry more weight than the words of a first term member of Congress.
Well, they're both politicians. Well, actually, Trump isn't a politician.
They're both people who are in elected office. The
true,
presidency
true.
Is a much more senior office than a first term member of Congress. So I actually think what comes out of the president's mouth, because the president is a representative of the United States in the world also. I mean, most people in France have never heard of Rashida Tlaib. or any of the other members of that cadre of first term Congress members.
Right. Yeah.
So really, what the president says matters a lot more. At least 10 times as much.
In your book, it does.
What's that?
I think it matters. I think it's the same thing with anybody, whether you're a politician or not.
Well, except
that if you use foul language, especially in public.
It
doesn't get to me. I just don't like it, to be honest.
Yeah. If you have a microphone in front of you, and then you got to count the millions who are listening, I guess. That's all I'm talking about. So,
okay.
Hey, thank you very much for the call, though. I appreciate it. So we got a good full studio this morning, our little room here at WDEV. It's about maybe 5x5 or something. I've never measured it, but we now have 4 people in here. And so here we go. Let's see. We're going to be talking about, as I mentioned, 4-H, Venerable Organization of Vermont. I'm dying to learn all about it. And the director is Sarah Kleinman. She is here in the studio. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning. How are you?
All right. And let's see here. We have a 4-H student. Lena Ashew is a junior at Champlain Valley Union High School over in Hinesburg. And Lena, right back into the mic there and say good morning to folks.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Alrighty. And Lena's mom is Sarah Nilsson, also works at the University of Vermont. I'm curious to find out a little bit about that. And Sarah, thanks for coming in. Really appreciate your participation as well.
Thank you for having us, and good morning.
Good morning. So first off, let me go to Sarah Kleinman. I've got 2 Sarahs here, too, just to try to keep me on my toes, getting confused or something. Sarah Kleinman is the director, and Sarah Kleinman, Ms. Kleinman, tell us about where this fits in the whole relationship with the University of Vermont Extension, for instance.
Sure. So 4-H is the nation's youth development program. It's a program that has some leadership that came out of USDA. And the University of Vermont Extension, of course, receives funding through USDA. So UVM Extension, which is a department within the College of Ag and Life Sciences, supports, builds healthy Vermonters. And so we do that through a variety of different ways, whether it's agriculture or natural resource programming, family and youth programming, food and nutrition, all sorts of areas. So 4-H builds life and job skills for youth ages 5 to 18. And we do that under the auspice of UVM Extension and its Healthy Families Initiative.
Wow. And so refresh me. Maybe I'll put this to Lena just as a little quiz here. I'm sure you'll pass it with flying colors. What do the 4-H's stand for?
Good question. The 4-H's stand for hands, heart, health, and head. There we go.
Had to get a little hint there.
Yeah, keeping on my toes.
So that's okay. Hands, health, heart, and head. And it sounds like all those 4 things are things that folks want to keep in good shape. Sarah Kleinman, tell us a little bit about the group in Vermont. How large is it? Is Vermont's chapter exceptionally strong by national standards? Does it need some catching up to do with other states, or how are we doing?
Sure. So I've been around about 17 years, and our numbers of youth participation have actually remained relatively flat. Despite the declining youth population, we continue to reach about 8% of the total youth population in the state. But we have a variety of programming or delivery modes that we call. So there are 4-H clubs. That's often what people think about when they think about 4-H. They may see youth parading animals around the fairs and field days or displays that are posted up. And those youth are typically those that are involved in the 4-H club programming. We have about 1,300 youth that support or that participate in that method. And then we do all sorts of other kinds of opportunities. We provide programming in schools. We collaborate with after-school programs. We offer some standalone opportunities, mentoring-type opportunities, summer camps. So altogether, we reach about 6,500 youth. That may seem small. For Vermont compared to other states, it's a small number, but at the same time, I think population-wise, we're fairly on par with our colleagues all across the country.
I see. My sort of vague image of 4-H over the years, I'd never been a participant myself, but was that it has a lot of, it's it's sort of born out of agriculture. A lot of farm kids tend to do 4-H. Is that really the case, or is that just sort of a stereotype in my mind, or how would you?
Currently, it's a stereotype. Historically, that was absolutely the case. So 4-H was initially born because research at the university was trying to make advancements, or excuse me, it was making advancements, but the researchers found that parents were sometimes resilient, you know, we're not receptive to those advancements or willing to make behavioral changes. And so researchers discovered that if we went to kids and taught them new things, that they were more likely, more influential to put pressure on their parents to try these new things. And really, that's how 4-H was born over 100 years ago. Currently, agriculture is still strong, of course, in our club program especially. We still have lots of youth that are gravitating towards equine projects and dairy projects. But at the same time, our initiatives focus in on healthy living education, civic engagement, and science or STEAM. We have a lot of youth participating in robotics, environmental, and natural resource-based programming. So it's really what we try to do is provide all sorts of opportunities. We're calling them sparks, where we might spark somebody's interest. And then it's through that interest and exploration that youth learn life and job skills. So for us, the content is almost secondary to the life, to the soft skill learning that occurs through that exploration of those content areas.
And Lena Ashew, are you a farm girl? Are you growing up on a dairy farm or on any kind of farm?
No, I am not. I'm actually in Shelburne in Chittenden County. But one of the most influential things I think about 4-H is being able to interact with kids that are growing up on farms and in rural parts of Vermont. I think it's very easy in developed Chittenden County to forget about the agriculture that exists across the state, other than just driving past the farms that we see on the way to school. And I think it's awesome in 4-H to be able to spend a week at the fair with a group of kids who are living on farms and to build lifelong relationships with these kids that we normally wouldn't have the chance to interact with.
And let me ask your mom, Sarah Nilsson, what your perspective on the fact that your daughter is in 4-H? Do you see it as a worthwhile program for her?
Oh, I think the program really is key to being a Vermonter. Like Lena was saying, growing up in Chittenden County, you don't have the opportunity to really experience the farms and the rural economy that's sort of central to the state. So, Lena, luckily we have Shelburne Farms, which is just a wonderful resource, and they have a dairy herd there, and Lena's been able to show dairy cows now for 5 years. Is that right? How many years have you been showing dairy cows? Seven years of sharing, wow. Showing dairy cows. So you've gotten to meet many people living on farms locally in Shelburne. You know the people that have the farms in Shelburne and then throughout the state, Addison County. And it's been a wonderful understanding of how food systems work in the state, how agriculture works, how the dairy industry works. So it's really opened up doors to all different types of issues related to dairy farming.
Wow, we're going to talk more about that after a brief break for some bottom of the hour news from CBS. A couple words from sponsors. More on 4-H on the Dave Graham Show to follow, folks. Stay with us.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
And we are back, continuing our conversation about 4-H. Let's see, heart, health, hands and head.
Good job. How to do? Impressive. Really good.
Yeah. And my guests are Lena Ashew. She's a junior at Champlain Valley Union High School over in Hinesburg. She comes from Shelburne, and Lena is a member of 4-H. Her mom, Sarah Nilsson, is here, and so is another Sarah. Sarah Kleinman is the director of 4-H in Vermont, works with the University of Vermont Extension Service, and I've been curious about 4-H for a while, so I'm really pleased to have the three of you in the studio with me this morning to tell us all about it. And Lena, let me ask you, you were mentioning a little bit before the break that you get around to a couple of the fairs in the state. I gather that there's some limit on that. You do have to go to school and things, right?
Yeah, I guess.
tell us what fairs you get to, and you were saying there are a couple that you don't get to that you would like to but haven't yet.
Yeah, so our club always goes to the Multi-County Fair, which is a very small fair that's sometimes hosted at Shelburne Farms, and it's only a single-day fair, but it's always a lot of fun. And then we also go to the Addison County Fair, of course, which is a week-long fair in Addison County, and that probably is my favorite. We always stay in a camper and spend the whole week at the fair, and so that's always a lot of fun.
How did your diet do that? Were you a lot of fried dough?
Oh, or what's the... yes, a lot of baked potatoes.
Baked potatoes, okay. High-carb situation, it sounds like. So. And now, but you don't get the Tunbridge or Barton or any of the really outlying fairs around Vermont, right?
No, we don't. We go to the State Dairy Fair, Dairy Show, and that always brings kids who do go to Tunbridge and Barton Fair, and we always hear a lot about their fairs from them, but... No, I've never been myself.
Yeah, and you mentioned that you're not as maybe it's the wrong phrase, but I asked you earlier if you were a farm girl. You said, "Well, no, you come from Shelburne, a Chittenden County suburb of Burlington, and there are some farms still in Shelburne, and so it's possible, but maybe a little less likely than if you, I don't know, came from." Up in the Northeast Kingdom or something somewhere. But how does this shape up with career plans for you? Do you have an idea that you'd like to grow up and work in agriculture, or tell us about that?
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the things that's remarkable about 4-H is the broad scope of professions that it's able to explore. So I'm in 4-H, but I'm also in something called Teen Science Cafe, where we explore science and science professions in Vermont in the STEM field. And so 4-H has really offered a wide variety of different career exploration paths. And so I think definitely agriculture is something that I've been exposed to. But within agriculture, I've learned about some of the complexities and difficulties of being a dairy farmer in Vermont. And so that's kind of steered me away from plans of pursuing agriculture in the future. But definitely through Teen Science Cafes, and all these other wonderful programming that 4-H offers, I've had a much better understanding of what I would like to pursue in the future.
That's cool. Now, do you have siblings, and are they in 4-H?
Yeah, I have two siblings, and they aren't in 4-H, but they always come to the fair. They like seeing the cows.
Excellent. That sounds like a lot of fun. And just in terms of the career planning and maybe college planning, you're probably starting to think about now as a junior at CVU. It's interesting. I had some folks here on the show last week, soil scientists from the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. And it's just amazing when you start looking into fields like that, because soil science touches on everything from not just the right soil and the right treatment for your soil, et cetera, to think about growing various crops and so on. But it extends everything to the kind of soil you want to when you're going to build a road. You know, how well does the soil drain, the kind of soil you want around a house so you don't get water in your basement. There's all sorts of civil engineering aspects really to soil science. And so it is amazing how the various agricultural fields that you might end up studying could branch out into so many different directions.
That's part of what we do, too, is provide all sorts of opportunities to explore different careers. We have a tri-state ag tour that helps youth see careers in the food systems beyond farming. Mm-hmm. So really, whether it's financing or business or cheese making or packaging and marketing, we're really trying to look at, holistically what the food system and agricultural systems need and then explore those opportunities, because we know we need the youth to stay in Vermont and fill those careers. Certainly. And so soil science is one of them. In fact, the science cafe that Lena was just talking about this past weekend had 60 youth come for 2 hours to learn from scientists, some PhD students at the university, to talk exactly about what you just talked about. And then the youth got to have hands-on experiences learning about silt and clay and I forget what else, but lots of fun.
Yeah, that is fascinating. And I mean, it's one of the most fun things about doing this show for me is that I get just an amazing range of little lessons myself from at Soil Science one day. Earlier today, I was talking to somebody about the Vermont Humanities Council and all, arts and literature and all that great stuff. So it's it really is a great opportunity here. But the Sarah Nilsson, you are Lena Ashew's mom, and once again, we were mentioning the University of Vermont. I understand you teach there. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
What's your field?
Film and television.
Oh, a little different from.
A little different.
Although, you know, there's
closer to radio than probably.
Yeah, probably a lot of opportunities for videographers and so on to do agricultural training films and
absolutely.
Any number of things. So. There's overlap even there. It's it truly is a.
I'm actually a Disney historian,
so I do
film and film and television history. But I am teaching a course right now on animals in film, and a lot of it is about conservation and sustainability and sort of social justice media. So that is definitely something that crosses over in terms of agriculture.
That's fascinating, huh? I might have to have you back sometime to talk about the history of Disney here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
I'd love to do that.
We just, as I say, the subjects are endless here. This is a real university for me, so it's a blast. But I wonder, in terms of just refocusing our attention now a little bit on 4-H, Sarah Kleinman. Are you actively working to try to, you mentioned the population of kids involved being flat. Are there any efforts going on to change that, to do more recruiting or that sort of thing?
There's always efforts to change that. Youth are busier these days, and so mm-hmm. it's much harder to find youth that are willing to perhaps join the club program, which starts, it's all year, every year, and you can do that for many years. Mm-hmm. People are much more apt to take part in a short-term program. So we've definitely evolved our programs and how they're delivered to be more short-term, if you will, or be more focused in career exploration, especially for the teen population. We don't have much of a problem getting youth when they're early, kindergarten, first, second, elementary school age to participate. But of course, as children age, they become busier, whether it's jobs or schools and sports. And so we're doing more and more in evolving our programs to make sure that there's opportunity for the teens to stay engaged. We're also looking for programming in different populations, whether it's, if you would call inner city Burlington or Winooski, but trying to reach different populations with different kinds of programs.
That is interesting, and I know just from what I hear from a wide variety of youth counselors, teachers, program directors, and so on, it seems like you want to support everything, but there's also this incredible competition out there for kids' time and attention, and people talk a lot about, obviously, about all the media out there and kids spending all their time on their phones and so on. But I think it's also, as you mentioned, sports, music, theater, all these other extracurricular activities in school that want to draw on kids' time. When you go, how does it work, actually? In other words, if I, as for young kids in school, how do they first hear about 4-H and what's the intro?
Really, there's a variety of entryways and pathways. There's no one way that youth might participate in our programs or learn about that. We advertise everywhere that we can, whether it's at public events. I think there's something at the Champlain Valley Fair even this weekend that's animal related, Wag Your Tail. And so we're going to be there with a display. We will be in schools. We're part of PTO fairs and events that they have at the start of school year. We put ads on Front Porch Forum. So every public possibly facing venue that we can be in to let people know that 4-H is alive and well, being on your radio show today, Across the Fence, all those sorts of avenues is a way for youth to get involved and for parents to realize that we're still here in existence. We do a lot in collaboration with other organizations too, especially after school programs. So again, the 4-H club model is one very specific thing that we own, if you will, in collaboration with community volunteers. But all the other short-term programs oftentimes are in collaboration with schools or after-school programs or other organizations so that we can really sustain what we're doing and reach different audiences.
So if you are the parent of a 8-year-old kid who is expressing an interest in things, you think, wow, I bet you 4-H is doing stuff with this activity. Mm-hmm. My kid's an avid gardener, and who knew? But, yeah. the parent and the child can reach out via how? What's the best way to reach out to the 4-H?
They can go to our website, uvm.edu/extension. Simply Google 4-H and UVM, and you'll find us. They can also call any of our local extension offices. And we have a Facebook page for about 4-H and avenues. Yeah,
so they're
keeping up with modern times.
Yeah, a lot of ways to reach out to 4-H and be in touch with the organization. It sounds like just a lot of fun and a way to really get our kids appreciating the fact that we have a strong agricultural tradition here in Vermont and in our country, and heaven knows it is vitally important because we all have to eat. So that's the bottom line here for a lot of folks. I wanted to get a little more specific about some of what you actually do with the time you devote to 4-H, Lena. And one of the things it sounds like you're involved with is actually some real hands-on care of cows. Is that right?
Yeah, one of the things that we're responsible to do as 4-H'ers is keep track of our cows' medical history, the different shots and different treatments that they're getting while they're on the farm, as well as be aware of the feed that they're receiving and why the dairy manager chooses silage versus grain to feed them, and her practices for making sure that they're going to be the most healthy milking cows in the future. And so that's all been really interesting.
Wow. And do you think that, I don't know, have you had any thoughts about wanting to be a veterinarian when you're an adult? Or is that something that you're being led in that direction at all?
Definitely. Yeah. I've always been interested in animal science. I'm actually interested in studying primates.
Really?
And I thought cows were closest thing I could get in Vermont.
Four-legged instead of two-legged. But yeah. That's interesting. So when you're working with these cows, obviously large animals, I mean, I would think and you're a fairly small framed person yourself. Do you ever feel intimidated around them at all, or?
I'm at times. They're incredibly sweet and incredibly intelligent, and so it's really fun to work with them. You get a cow at a really young age, also, so you're really training them from only a couple months old into just before they're milking. So that's also interesting, seeing their development. But you create a pretty remarkable bond with the animals, and it's really fun to be at the fair and spend a whole week with them. So
you have it sounds like you may have a career path in mind that actually involves you working with primates, you said?
That would be nice.
what do you imagine there, working in a zoo or going over to Africa doing research in the jungles over there, or what do you think?
Yeah, definitely being in 4-H, I've realized that I really love observing animals, and so I think I'd be interested in studying primate behavior. So that'd be awesome to go to Africa.
Wow, yeah, that really would be, and obviously there's a long road there academically. You'd probably end up working toward your PhD or something, but you have a good role model in academia with your mom being a professor at the University of Vermont. So there you go. I think you may be on a good road here, Lena. I really do have that sense. The other thing I wanted to ask about was, I understand that the 4-H does a lot of work in bringing along younger children, and that sometimes the older teenage members of 4-H are involved in those efforts. Sarah Kleinman, what can you tell us about that?
Sure. So you had asked earlier, too, about how we're keeping up with the times, if you will. And so what we call Tribe for the Environment, or Teens Reaching Youth, is another model of programming. And so it's really a two-step or two-part opportunity where we take teams of older youth along with an adult mentor, and they learn one of a handful of different environmental curricula, usually 6 to 8 week sessions. And then also about classroom management and behavior or child development. And then those teens are then responsible for giving back and going into environments in their communities, whether it's after school programs or classrooms or maybe a program at the library, and then deliver a 6 to 8 week program for younger youth. It might be on energy, it may be alternative energy, compost composting. You did the Try 4-H. So another model, similarly, where we did teens reaching youth through 4-H programming, where they would go and staff tables or deliver short-term programs to try to get younger youth interested in the 4-H model. So it's a great way. The older kids learn about classroom behavior, workforce skills, teaching, and see if that's a career that they wish to further explore. But then we're providing a service for the younger youth as well.
I was going to say, if you are in high school and you are thinking about being a teacher almost in any subject, it sounds like this might be an interesting activity for you to explore, because it would give you that taste of, I mean, if you're supposed to prepare 4 to 8 weeks worth of lesson plans, that's got to be quite a project right there.
Right, exactly. And we do provide a lot of those materials for them. But absolutely, it gives you that hands-on opportunity to really try and explore. And that's what 4-H is all about, whether it's through the dairy animals and through a club setting or through any of our other short-term programs, really understanding by trying, practicing, exploring, whether or not these career paths, if you will, or workforce skills is something for you.
One interesting thing I heard recently that on this program, in fact, involved the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. And we're actually doing a weekly segment with CALS, as it's called, the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. We're calling it our Seeds to Society segment here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, and working to sort of formalize more of a partnership with CALS, because I'm really loving this opportunity, because it seems as though they are that particular branch of the University of Vermont is delving into so many different topics, many of which are very important to Vermont's agricultural tradition, but also extend well beyond that. And so our Seeds to Society segment, of which today is one example, I meant to mention the CALS folks are being very, very helpful with putting this together. And we had a segment last week, and one of the topics that came up in a very brief manner, which I want to delve into at some point more deeply, concerned new arrivals in Vermont, particularly folks from Africa who are getting some help from people via the University of Vermont Extension and others affiliated with learning how to adapt their historic and traditional farming that they were doing back in Africa to life in Vermont. I mean, it's obviously a way different climate. Have you learned anything about that project, Lena?
I haven't learned about that project, but one of the programs that is affiliated with UVM Extension is the Vermont Migrant Education Program.
Mm-hmm.
And I recently helped Vermont Migrant Education Program run a 2-day conference called Mi Vida Mi Voz, which connected migrant and rural kids from across Vermont for a really fun writing conference. And that was facilitated by a grant from Vermont After School. And we're running the program again this year, so if there's any interest.
Wow.
And it was children from mostly dairy workers, so migrant workers on dairy farms, their children who typically don't have educational opportunities. Because of you working with 4-H, you were aware of these kids and you set up this program. And luckily, Migrant Ed was available. So it was a great partnership between basically your experience with 4-H and then Migrant Ed. And these kids never have programming during the summer, and they were able to do a 2-day writing workshop. So it was a great opportunity for everybody.
That does sound like a terrific opportunity. Lena, how's your Spanish?
Very bad.
Mi vida, mi voz. I'm thinking, is that my life, my voice? Is
yes.
That, how am I doing on that? Okay. I took a little Spanish in high school, but that's about the extent of my training there. And no me acuerdo mucho. I think that means I don't remember much. But again, wonderful opportunities here for kids in 4-H actually to rub elbows with folks, with young people from families who are coming up here from Mexico, elsewhere outside the country, working on farms in Vermont. It's just another way to broaden the overall experience. And it sounds like an increasingly important part of that, would you say, Sarah?
Definitely. The Migrant Ed program, as well as all the others that we offer through UVM Extension, is really about, again, providing opportunity to build both life and job skills. So whether it's formal education, whether it's building, again, the soft skills, leadership opportunities, exploring different sparks, that's all that we're about doing and making sure that youth and families have resilience so that they can weather any challenges that might come their way.
We are nearing the top of the hour here. I want to get some sort of conclusory remarks going here. So, Lena, tell me, what would you say is the most important thing you have learned in your 4-H experience?
That's a great question. I think it's just, it's amazing being in Vermont to get to know these kids who are working with their families on dairy farms. I think I'm always impressed by their hard work, and especially as we're... as a country, we're shifting towards working towards more farming practices that are healthier for the environment. It's awesome to see kids who are really engaged with issues such as climate change, who are also working towards being sustainable farmers in the future. And it's very inspiring and makes me hopeful for the future.
That's great. And that is what we want. I want to thank my three guests this morning. It's really been an interesting and inspiring conversation, I think, here to find out about 4-H. This venerable organization has been around a long time. It clearly is adapting to the modern situation in agriculture and in the environment as we go forward. And that is a terrific thing. My guest, Sarah Kleinman, is the director of the 4-H for Vermont, works for the University of Vermont Extension. Lena Ashew is a junior at Champlain Valley Union High School and a 4-H student. Her mom also joining us this morning, Sarah Nilsson. And three of you, thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And we are, as I said, fast approaching the top of the hour. The Dave Graham Show broadcasts every morning here on WDEV from 9 to about 11 a.m. And we really enjoy doing so, and wish you folks join us every morning if you can, or listen to our podcast if you can't, and keep up with what we're doing here. It's a wide variety of topics. As for now, we're going to call it quits for today. Bill Sayre and Common Sense Radio follow in just a bit, and then the Midday News Service here on WDEV. And we will be back tomorrow with another edition of our program. Have a great day, everybody.